and welcome to the Inside Betting Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Trenhale. So, episode 14, and I think I can say quite safely that episode 13, my first interview with Kieran, was pretty well received. I had some very nice comments from a lot of people. A lot of people have said they enjoyed it. I feel like I have possibly peaked a little bit. Debatable whether I want to carry on, really, but I'm afraid I am going to keep going. Don't know how long it will take me to find the next interview, necessarily. And it can be quite tiring, if I'm honest, trying to ask sensible and meaningful questions, if that can be believed. But the spreadsheet definitely helped, so I feel like I've validated that approach. And I would hope that if you weren't already signed up to Kieran's bettedup.com newsletter, which continues to have some very good stuff in it, or at least giving the Sports Thoughts podcast a bit of a go, then I hope maybe that interview would convince you to give it a try, because I certainly enjoy it. I'm not, in any podcast case, I'm never a massive fan of lists of picks and reasoning, and while I'm very much a fan and supporter of using mathematical models in betting, it's quite tough when people read out picks with the justification my model says. Bet the Process and Sports Thoughts slightly got caught in this cycle. Personally, I love to hear thoughts about thoughts on betting and the processes and how they come up with the numbers more than those kind of things. But at the same time, I understand a lot of people like to have picks to then bet themselves, and certainly if they come from reliable and intelligent sources. I want to say do give that podcast a go if you haven't already. I have to admit, I was desperately hoping that maybe Kieran would mention how much he enjoyed being on my podcast, on their podcast, but sadly not to be. I definitely think that the betting podcast could benefit from spreading the love towards each other a bit. Like I say, Bet the Process, Sports Thoughts, Business of Betting podcast, all very worthy listens. I think the Matchbook podcast has a lot of good stuff on it. And I certainly hope that there is some crossover between my listenership and some of theirs, and hopefully maybe some of them will direct some of their listeners towards mine, even if mine is possibly a bit more boring than theirs and less picks orientated. Someone who managed to get out their second episode of their podcast was Pinnacle, and it was with the generally quite fascinating Marco Bloom, the head of trading. I've got to the point now, I feel like, that I know pretty much all of Mr. Bloom's patter for these how Pinnacle works and what's it like to be a trader in Pinnacle. Covers a lot of the same ground each time, but if you haven't heard Marco Bloom talk about workings of Pinnacle, he's always a good listen, and the second podcast of theirs is a nice little interview with him. Possibly the only thing that I maybe, not new thing that I got afresh, but one thing I liked that I sort of hadn't heard referenced specifically in this way before, was right at the end of the podcast, he talks about misconceptions and the idea that parlays or multiples are not for, you know, smart bettors or professionals, and he says he disagrees. And I very much fall in that camp as well. I think you know, multiple bets and parlays are an excellent addition to any serious bettor's armoury if used correctly. And what I liked particularly was the way he phrased the advantage of multiples as a way of getting more money down, which I like the way he explained that if you think of it in terms of sequential bets, you're effectively rolling over one bet to another. So let's say there was three bets in your multiple. By the time you get to the third bet, you're effectively having quite a large bet after the first two legs have won. Which is an interesting way of looking at it, and I always think of it as in terms of gearing or leveraging multiple positive EV bets to create sort of far greater upside to sort of still relatively small downside. That is, of course, compensated by the fact, or offset by the fact, that obviously when you have multiples or accumulators, parlays, whatever you want to call them, the odds will be bigger. And so while you have bigger returns, that's the nature of very obviously of bigger odds. But when you multiply out positive expectation, that multiplication is very powerful in terms of leveraging your betting knowledge. And yes, I liked that way of looking at it. And I thought it was I was a bit, not downhearted, but you know, I got to the end of the podcast and I hadn't really heard anything new or different, and Marco's pretty consistent with how he talks about these things again and again, but that was one thing that I hadn't necessarily heard him speak about before, and I thought that was a nice way of explaining the advantages of multiples there. So yeah, I would definitely recommend people to give that a go. I hope that Pinnacle sort of ramp up their podcast so that it's sort of pumping out as much content possibly as the written stuff they do. You know, I don't know if they're going to get an established set of contributors for it, or whether it's just going to be done for major events. But yeah, I guess they're still finding their way regarding that. But you know, yes, it's sort of, they're certainly behind someone like Matchbook, who is producing almost too much content to listen to at times across a wide range of sports. But I'm sure they'll get there, because you know, all their articles, educational articles they've done, have, you know, that's really now quite an impressive body of work. They've, you know, there's one or two duff ones in there, but there's a lot of good stuff in there as well. So I'm sure they will get there. Just come back from holiday. Had a lovely holiday, lovely time off in Ireland, and a few people sent me messages while I was away on holiday, which I'm sorry, I tried to get off all forms of internet and Twitter as much as I could, which I think did me the power of good, to be honest. Some questions that came though while I was away. One, Colonel Braxton at quarter the first four, is there a place for horse racing at the likes of Pinnacle, Mustard, etc.? The exchange has rather cornered that market, and I'll say what I mean there, in that Pinnacle or Mustard, they either need to take recreational bets, make money the way conventional bookmakers do, or they need to be able to monetize the smart information from smart bettors if they're not going to close any accounts. So for horse racing, with multi-runner events, it is harder to create an arbitrage in order to offset the smart bets you receive, and so you know, you really need that sort of back and lay function to be able to shift the money rapidly. So you know, with Betfair, if you were a market maker on Betfair and you laid a bet to someone, you can very quickly move your odds and sort of counteract the position on the same horse, whereas if you're only offering one side, like a conventional bookmaker or even like Pinnacle Mustard, then you have to basically shape your whole book. You know, you'll lay a bet, you shorten up that, you make all the other horses bigger odds, or to some degree maybe you have an original starting price that you sort of lean more towards or away from depending on the information that you get. But either way, you're then victim again to the next person who may be better than you, potentially taking another horse. And now you've taken two negative EV bets from smart punters, and so you're adjusting your book again. So you need to create more and more volume to get to that point where you've gone such a big odds on something that you're attracting, I suppose, a recreational business, which is kind of counterintuitive because by definition recreational business isn't that price sensitive, so they're not actively looking necessarily for the very biggest price. So it's hard to balance multi-runner events. You know, it's why Pinnacle, when they've done outrights in general, have very tiny limits on them. And it sort of can be hard to shape a book. And quite often, when you look at the books and these kind of things, you've got a few standout large liabilities which you've taken at points, probably when the market wasn't that well evolved or that well constructed. And you just kind of have to sit on those, and you're just sort of a bit overbroke, unfortunately. So it can be very hard. But of course, with the exchange, you can effectively, by moving your price, you can sort of knock it out the other side, if need be, and even, you know, have more on effectively yourself in an easier fashion. So, you know, someone like Pinnacle and Mustard, definitely there is a way to optimize the dynamic odds movements based on a risk profile, based on bets taken, but you do require to get up to a more of a critical mass of bets in order to. And if you're not yourself creating arbs with the exchange, with your prices in that backing sense, if you're not backing back liabilities and therefore directly using the punt smart punters information, it's quite hard to do. I would suggest that a bookmaker who was going to do it would potentially need to be connected to the exchange themselves and effectively be using the bets from the customers to shape their book, and then also using that information by placing bets on the exchange and vice versa. So sort of market making in the exchange and market making also as a bookmaker, which in fact is where we're going to find the likes of Smarkets, and now it turns out the likes of Matchbook are going to be having a face, you know, bookmaker face on top of the exchange. Which I'm going to today's episode, I want to talk about. I want to talk about premium charges on exchanges, and that will all come into that. So, in answer to that question, it can be done, it's difficult, and it probably would help if someone was willing to commit to connecting themselves to an exchange. And that then means that you're incurring costs associated with the exchange yourself as a bookmaker. Not as easy to do as, say, two runner markets where, you know, like tennis, someone places a bet, you can just create an arb the other side pretty easily and attract business back the other way. One other question came from at Dark Dyson. He asked me and Berry Horse, Kieran, about Monetum crypto project. I have not had a chance to look through the ICO for this, but I will do when I get a chance. So sorry about that. One thing I would like, if anyone can help me out, while I was in, while I was in Ireland, a lot of the betting shops over there have posters in the windows lambasting the increase in tax that recently happened for not just bookmakers but for exchanges as well in Ireland. I read a little piece, a little bit of industry press about it before I left for Ireland. I'd be very interested if anyone has any stuff out of Ireland that they can post, written about it, particularly if we can get something balanced, so something from, you know, the government side as to what they're hoping to achieve with the taxation changes, you know, something hopefully beyond just we want more money, sort of a bit clearer explanation on it, and also what, for how they're, I mean, the bookmakers obviously framing it as terrible. No one wants to pay more tax, but a bit more than that, if anyone can sort of, because these posters in the betting shops while I was out in Ireland, very much saying how, you know, it's going to cause closure of shops, redundancies, etc. So I'd like to get a feel if anyone has any literature out there or any articles that were posted regarding it, or even just some more details about it, because I didn't really capture the full impact of the taxation changes. But that's always interesting. But yeah, just before I left on holiday, there was talk on Twitter, particularly about Matchbook deploying a premium charge. and there was also people trying to get a statement out of Jonathan Trost, in charge of Smarkets or owns Smarkets, trying to get him on the record as saying, you know, how he felt about premium charges. He had come out sympathetically, interestingly, to Matchbook regarding the deployment of their premium charge. A lot of debate about the minimum amount needed to be made before the, you know, they've stuck it at 20 grand, I think, compared, which is significantly lower than, say, Betfair's. And yeah, there was sort of just general speculation about, you know, what are they doing it, why are they doing it, etc., etc. Now, I debated about trying to speak to people from the exchanges themselves, trying to get someone to speak to, and someone even offered to talk about premium charging. But I kind of thought that I would give my own thoughts about it and what I perceive to be the issue surrounding premium charge. And then possibly if anyone either, if they agree with, any of the exchanges agree with me, then they should retweet and applaud me for, you know, agreeing with them. Or if it is something that they think is absolutely abhorrent, then they should ask to come on, I suppose, and explain more. I, as always, as anyone who listens to this podcast will know, take a realist slash sympathetic attitude towards a lot of industry practice, predominantly born out of the fact that I've worked in it and seen some of the difficulties from the bookmaking perspective, I suppose, or the exchange perspective from this side, and bookmakers and betting exchange, etc., generally pretty terrible at explaining why they do what they do, often because the answer is quite unpalatable. I wouldn't make great PR, but also because they just don't ever sort of feel the need to. But I feel that sometimes exchanges in particular could sort of go to greater lengths to help people understand the way they structure themselves, the decisions they make, and so on. So yeah, that's going to be today's podcast, and we'll start with, as always, when I talk about the exchange, and it's a phrase now that I notice is a lot of people are using, is the ecosystem of the exchange and the people who participate on a sports betting exchange. So, first things first, we ought to say that sports betting exchanges are essentially completely of no value to society whatsoever. And utterly pointless in many regards. They don't fulfill any function beyond facilitating betting or trading on sports, and consequently they are not like a financial exchange, and this creates some significant differences between the two. While there are people undoubtedly engaged in financial trading purely for the point of making money from the trade or the act of trading, exchanges also facilitate you know, the purchasing of shares, and companies have shares for a reason. They allow the easy management of funds for more long-term horizon views, such as people's pensions and so on. So they have a variety of real use, I suppose. And this is what means that these two products will always be sort of different. Financial exchanges have people who want to trade over a wide array of time frames, a very wide array of time frames, from nanoseconds up to decades. So that's very important. And they have varying degrees of price sensitivity as well, invariably linked to the time frame. So to the nanosecond, you're talking about the desire to have zero slippage, as they would call it. You want to get the exact price at that split nanosecond, right down to someone who wants to buy, you know, some state fund, who wants to buy, you know, a million shares of something and they want to do it over the next 6 months, sort of gently, and, you know, as long as they're holding that many shares by the end of the 6 months, that's all that really matters. And as long as they sort of roughly match the average price trend of the stock during that time, no one's too bothered. So when you combine these two together, you create an opportunity for both to sort of exist. Effectively, the high frequency trader, they perform, I suppose, even they are not entirely, people, a lot of people like to think of them as being parasitic, just extracting money out of the market without providing any benefit. But I don't know, I come from someone who had to manually execute quite a lot of trades when I worked in finance. It certainly just made my life a lot bloody easier, because they're almost like the oil in an engine. They just reduce the friction. So being able to place a trade very quickly, and they effectively do reduce spreads. I think there's enough papers now to sort of agree that it's possibly not as much as they think they reduce spreads, but they do reduce spreads, so effectively reduces transaction cost if your style of trading is you just need to get trades done in a relatively timely fashion, and you're not hypersensitive about to the nearest penny or cent, how accurate the prices you do. So even they perform some sort of function, but obviously their primary purpose is just to make their owners, high frequency trading firms, owners money. But if you look at someone, they can then engage in, I suppose, what you might call sort of not even symbiotic, it is slightly parasitic behavior, in that when a large body who is price insensitive wants to place a large order, they can do their business in between the bid and ask of the spread, and make little small micro captures of buying and selling there as people put in rather indiscriminate large orders into the market, or possibly have, sometimes people place a large order by just, I suppose the equivalent would be if you have Betfair trading software, so they call it a drip. Effectively, you're just dropping an order into the market to buy over time, and you're just hoping to get a reasonable average price without spooking the market too much, if you're going to be buying a lot. I do wonder whether someone like, traditional, say, buy and hold funds, someone like Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, I do wonder how much they squeeze the pips on execution, I imagine just because when you're big enough, you can afford to pay people to sort of take real due care over it. But, if Buffett wants to buy a chunk of Apple, I don't know whether he's got people working, orders on the bid all day for him or whatever, whether he's sort of taking a huge amount of time over maximizing the execution, or whether, essentially he's happy to get the order done today because, by definition, the value he wants to realize will come by holding it for, a prolonged period of time, rather than dickering over, 5-10 cents either way. Now, you may say, well, 5-10 cents of, 5-10 cents difference in execution price on Apple in a huge size is a significant amount of money. But yeah, I don't know. Either way, he's not going to be as pernickety as a high frequency trading fund, for example. So he is someone who's sharp, but not particularly price exacting necessarily, and he's got one time frame. You've got people who aren't necessarily sharp in the investor sense, like a large pension fund, or even something like an ETF, which has to track an index. New stock goes into the index, stocks fall out of it, they need to rebalance, they need to get to the point where they represent the index as quickly as possible. A lot of people do try to get ahead of these large orders that will happen when indexes need to index tracking funds need to rebalance, these kind of things. So there's a lot of people doing things which they can happily cohabit in the ecosystem of the financial trading markets without causing too many problems to each other. Sports betting exchanges, though, that's a different kettle of fish altogether, because sports events are ending in short time periods over and over again. there are not many long-term horizon events. You know, you maybe trade the winner of, say, the EPL, something like that. But by and large, you know, even in terms of that, you know, pre-match trading for a soccer match, you know, or just the length of the match, or even, you know, a test match in cricket, you know, even if it went to 5 days, you know, these are not particularly long time horizons, and they're all often, you know, just one instance of something over varying lengths of time. You know, if someone is trading, you know, for example, if someone is trading to win the EPL, and they've got that many, you know, 30 plus games of the season remaining to trade in and out, then you can have a slightly different behavior to how you trade that. But by and large, the majority of the money is turned over on sports betting exchanges on individual matches in a, you know, window, or races in a window before they start and during them. And there is no one there who can play the, if you like, the large dumb liquidity for their own purpose. You know, no one puts money onto the sports betting exchange in a lump just for the hell of it, really. You know, there's not that many people out there who are just willing to take massively under market price in a large size just because they want to bet on. Debatable, there may have been people once upon a time who did do things like that, but by and large now, you know, people you know, who use the exchanges are much more aware of how they work and much more savvy about it. So in effect, you have a lot of people all trying to do similar things in the similar time frames, all while being quite price sensitive. So this creates a sort of a dynamic that's at odds with itself all the time. The exchange relies on, all exchanges rely on market makers, effectively mini bookmakers inhabiting the exchange. Except these bookmakers maybe restrict themselves to a very limited number of markets or a limited number of sports, which they can have far greater expertise than, say, your standard recreational bookmaker needs to in terms of true price discovery. And this, you know, these people are what fill up a lot of the box. I think a lot of people sometimes do still look on exchanges and see money matching and prices moving around. And there's sort of this image of thousands and thousands of punters sort of dipping in and out, you know, putting offers up, putting offers down. No, these are often just a small handful of people who basically are market making and rebounding off each other in the markets. And they're the ones who are, you know, being price makers. So huge volume of the price making is done by a tiny fraction of accounts on the exchanges, and the vast majority of accounts are simply price takers, and this creates a problematic inequality in any sports betting exchange. People are very reluctant often to put an order up and just let it sit there because they don't know, you know, they don't want to leave it. Have I been matched? Have I not been matched? What if I put up the odds I wanted and I was completely happy that I wanted those odds, but it turns out that it traded one tick away from that, but I didn't get matched. But if I'd been there, sat in front of my computer, and I'd seen there was only one tick away, I would have taken it. Now it's one, I didn't get matched, didn't win. People get to the point where they just can't deal with that. So they just want to take the price there. They see a price, they think it's too big or too short, depending on that, they back and lay off that. So we have a glut of those people and a potentially diminishing amount of market makers, which is one of my concerns. Now, premium, to the general mentality of anyone who uses the exchange a lot, is that, and you know, rightly so, that more volume is better. We want as much volume going through the exchange as possible. Exchange can make as much commission as possible that way. And that is how we're going to make money. And there is a query of, you know, why should the premium charges exist? why are, and I see phrases like stealing and theft and so on. It's interesting. A lot of people are hypercritical of something that, you know, has basically given them a living out of nothing. If the exchange didn't exist, these people would have to be doing something else. You know, Betfair has effectively allowed some people to tell their bosses to fuck off and make lots of money. And while I can understand that it is quite depressing to have made a leap to, you know, make your life as a, you know, a Betfair trader, this isn't the London Stock Exchange or the COMEX or the CME or any other financial exchange, you know, destined to be around. You know, there was always going to be a certain element of, I don't know, insecurity regarding something that, you know, you're quite dependent on only one exchange, really. I think most people knew that when they're getting into Betfair, and no guarantee that the company would even exist indefinitely, let alone that they wouldn't change their business practice. But anyway, gone a bit too far down that path. But yes, so people are like, surely Betfair just grows and grows and grows, more and more volume goes through, and therefore, as volume increases, more commission is paid. You know, there we go. Now, the problem comes with, you may say, first of all, the way Betfair structured their commission rates, you could argue that only paying commission on winners was not necessarily the best structure. And you could say also that while it was entirely sensible to incentivize the increase in volume so that you could drive your commission rate down, maybe you weren't incentivizing volume in a way that was most beneficial to the exchange. So if we go way back into Betfair's history, and there were some fairly old school sort of market makers, I can never remember their name, there was a Scandinavian company, it was a listed Scandinavian company even on the stock exchange there, I think, which did a huge amount of market making for Betfair, almost in a sort of traditional bookmaker sort of style, you know, not even hugely sharp odds. And effectively, Betfair provided them the infrastructure to be a bookmaker, but without all the hassle of customer service and all the other crap, you know. Or, you know, effectively, they were doing all the deposits for them and everything. They could effectively act as a bookmaker, and people would go on the exchange. It was novel, it was new, it was interesting, and they could offer odds. And even if they just sort of kept themselves, their house relatively in order, they could make some reasonable money just taking people who wanted to have a normal bet trying something out. So people like that, they, you know, if they didn't up their game, they got squeezed out by syndicates and people who sort of took the market making far more seriously over time. But fortunately, these people certainly created plenty of volume and did plenty of market making around the sports which were perceived to be liquid and the most promising to create a vibrant market. So things like soccer and tennis and cricket and horse racing, they all didn't suffer from sort of some of the more naive market makers of early days maybe being on the decline, because new sort of more aggressive, bigger volume, to be honest, when specialists sort of really entered into the industry, they provided sort of far greater liquidity. So we got this point where, fantastic, we've got people who are new and excited to be using the betting exchanges coming in. They're, you know, a fresh load of price takers. We've got a large group of aggressive, bigger size market makers. Presumably we just keep both of these two groups growing and we'll do absolutely fine. Well, the problem was that I don't think necessarily people envisaged just how good people could become as price takers. So market makers were, you know, leaving resting orders on the bid, you know, on the back bid and the ask, sorry, on the back and the lay, on the exchange, and so they facilitated all those price takers. And they, you know, knew that there were rising numbers of recreational people using the exchange, so they were happy to sort of put that money up there. But there basically became a breed of experts. Now, a lot of people like to target, it's a bit niche this, depending on how well you sort of follow your Betfair history, I suppose. But a lot of people like to target court siding, practice of court siding, for the reason for the decline in, I suppose, recreational punter usage of Betfair, and the, you know, where the premium charge came in. Yes and no. I mean, there's something about that, but you know, I'm not entirely on board with that. So you can look at God, I can never remember the name of the chap, but the guy who was basically in charge of the largest tennis betting syndicate within Betfair, the one with all the prominent courtsiders. I think they were the one who had the one thrown out of the Aussie Open, and so on. And a lot of people said this unfair advantage of speed they had over the rest of the market meant that they shredded the poor innocent traders, new traders, completely. These new traders had no idea that the prices they were seeing were ahead of, you know, ahead of the TV pictures and all the rest of it. There's possibly something to that. Fundamentally, these people provided, after every single point, liquidity, you know, on the back and the lay side for people to bet in. You know, that is invaluable to an exchange. And they were happy and confident to do it. And the reason, you know, that obviously their advantage lay very much in the speed of information. I think even those people would agree that back then the modelling did not even have to be very sophisticated, just knowing, you know, who'd won a point. And people happily left up resting orders more on the exchange back then. People would have an idea, well, I want to back them at this, I want to lay them at this. They weren't even thinking about what the price would do if the went 15-40 or, you know, 2-0 in games. They would just had a distance between price A and price B that they liked the idea of. And so they put, so sometimes, you know, the market maker takes these orders down, it puts them all back up after the points won, and it just matches up against all the people who've left these orders up there. You know, they knew that they were taking prices at sort of value trade, value prices, because their model was okay, and they, you know, they got the news as fast as possible on the points. But these people did actually provide a very useful function towards liquidity on tennis on Betfair, because you need people who are fearless and confident in their market making in order to do this. Now, you may say, well, seems a bit cowardly for your only advantage to be, you know, the fact that you're 5-10 seconds ahead of the rest of the market. Well, yes, I mean, to be honest, the vast majority of people I knew back then, now admittedly I, you know, was socializing with a more sophisticated level of better, but even people who were just playing around on the exchange very quickly realized that, hang on, the prices are moving before the television pictures I'm watching. And most people didn't take very long to figure out just how much before the delay was. And once they figured that out, most people would wait for the market to settle and then place the bet after that. I used to read so many articles about people saying, you know, how unfair and how awful it was. To be honest, I just feel like once you assessed how the game was working, you adapt to that. Because there are undoubtedly people who bet between games on tennis back then, and even now, who know that they don't have the speed advantage, but are just happy that they calculate the prices better. And again, a lot of people would suggest that, oh, you need to be, you know, a sophisticated syndicate, all the rest of that. No, there's people making money betting on tennis in between games, in between sets, who are just either better intuitive readers of the game, or alternatively have just worked harder on their models, and they don't necessarily work at syndicates. They may do it in their bedroom in their free time, for, you know, for the examples I've seen. And some undoubtedly are syndicates and doing it, you know, trying to make it pay as well as possible. But yes, it's interesting now, you know. So the same chap whose name I can't remember, which is annoying, you know, he went and set up JABet, I think, which is basically essentially a website where you can back and lay tennis, and tennis only. So basically, yeah, so having been forced out of the Betfair ecosystem, you know, effectively now just offers a website where you can log in and bet on tennis on an interface that's basically the same as Betfair's, which is interesting. But yeah, so I think a lot of people felt like premium charge came in for those people because they were making so much money. You know, they were on 2%, they're barely paying any money towards Betfair. Betfair could see them and think, oh, look at them making so much money. You know, and potentially that they were then driving off casual bettors. We would lose our new generation of fresh and aspiring price takers to people like this came out there. I would say that the problem was not there so much, I don't think. For me, if you're putting up resting orders, you can only really be facilitating greater turnover, because the first step for anyone who joins an exchange is to be a price taker. It's another step before you become a price maker. So even if these people are operating under a huge advantage compared to the average punter, you still need them. That, you know, again, looking at financial markets, the vast majority of people who make the markets on, say, foreign exchange, whatever, they're far more sophisticated than you. You know, they generally are better at this than the average person who tries it for the first time. But people, you know, God, people try and crack the financial trading markets all the time, no matter how ill-equipped or ill-prepared they are to do it. So instead, I looked more to the other category of people who traded in big size and became very good at price taking. You know, these people who would take a position in a cricket match or in a tennis match, they might not even put in a back or lay a few ticks higher, a few ticks lower. Invariably, if they're doing it in running in particular, you can't afford to necessarily wait to get matched. If you see a price that you know to be value, you have to take the price and not be, as the financial tradings would say, a dick for a tick, you know, trying to squeeze every last bit out of it. You can do that more in the pre-match area, and more people were happy to sort of put up, you know, oh, okay, I'll put up 2.5 now, and if I haven't been matched fully by the time the match starts, I might just take some then. But increasingly it became apparent that, you know, Betfair's real strength happened on the in-play, really, and that's also where the recreational punter wanted to play a lot more, the trader, if you like, pre-race horse racing trading aside. So invariably you got people who took to Betfair trading and became pretty good at it, and as they got better and better, traded in larger and larger size, and these people became better than the market makers and consistently stayed ahead of market makers. And the reason being is, again, if we look at these people as being a small collection of bookmakers, specialist bookmakers on the exchange, in the same way that the very best bookmaker will still lose out to the very best punter, it's because the punter doesn't have to bet on everything all the time. They have the choice of no bet, whereas the market maker doesn't. And while you may say that the market makers on the exchange absolutely don't have to put anything up if they don't want to, they in general know that if they make money game after game, it's too hard, especially in an anonymous better environment, to decide when you're being matched on the exchange against someone who's very sophisticated versus when you're being matched against someone who may just wanted a large bet. So because they couldn't differentiate, because they couldn't effectively avoid taking bets from the counterparties that they maybe wouldn't want to, and because those people who were price takers and became very sophisticated were able to always get matched, they didn't have to worry about being closed or restricted or having their accounts, they could become, you know, better and better, more and more successful, down to 2%. These people benefited. Everyone on the exchange wants to benefit themselves, everyone wants to make money. They did not in any way benefit future exchange volumes. They were not putting up money to be matched a lot of the time, and they were just making, you know, they weren't making the exchange look more liquid or providing liquidity. They effectively were taking money out of the exchange that could have someone, you know, could have been matched against someone who would have been more inclined to. So if Market Maker clashes with Market Maker, it's fine. That's all great. If Market Maker provides liquidity to Naive Price Taker, that's also fine, because that's really how the Market Maker wants to be getting a bit more juice. You know, they don't want to just be fighting pros against pros all the time. So that's good. But if the Sophisticated Price Taker is constantly beating up on the Market Maker, it means that sometimes the Market Makers can be scared of pricing a market, or they may reduce the volume that they offer very much. So in a way, and they won't necessarily complain or moan about it or whatever, you know, the exchange is the exchange, but they will adapt their behavior. So you have a lot of people. So if you've got a lot of people that are effectively hampering the profitability of your market makers, they will impact liquidity that way. And they won't provide the liquidity themselves to sort of offset that. So they can damage the exchange ecosystem. Another example would be someone who essentially just is an aggressive bot price taker. So let's say you're someone who does your very best to price up soccer pre-match on Betfair. You've got your own little model. You've got a way of tracking Asia that's pretty quick. You're pretty happy with it. You combine the two, spit out some odds, and you make, you know, under over 1.5, 2.5, 3.5, 3, you know, the 1x2, correct score, whatever. You do that, and you're doing it for lots of different matches. You built yourself up, so you're doing it for 30 leagues or whatever, sort of, in a way, hoping to turn over as much volume as possible, make, you know, maybe 1%, 2%, whatever. Those people can then fall victim to someone who basically makes it their sole goal to be fastest to market. So let's say instead of doing all that effort to market make, let's say you basically just build the most sophisticated web scrapers you can to find the price moves at Pinnacle, or say, you know, maybe a chosen Asian bookmaker, and all you care about is that the moment they put up their odds or move their odds, that you basically hoover up all the money on the exchange instantly off the back of that. Now, someone who's gone to great efforts to sort of be quick, you know, they're still going to change within 10 seconds of these changes on the website, but, you know, they've got a lot of moving parts, it's got to feed through to the exchange, got to update, all the rest of it like that. So then they basically become victims to high-frequency traders, people who've basically turned execution into their edge, and that's all they care about. Now, people who market make and provide liquidity that they can make, the market maker can make money off to the vast majority of punters, can suddenly, and the thing is, the person who's made the sole purpose of their life speed of execution, they've probably got deep pockets, they're going to make money rapidly, and so they can just up and up and up. They're never going to take a step back, they're always going to be just increasing operation, and they'll beat that market maker into submission, unless that market maker prioritizes execution. But if they're prioritizing speed of execution, they can no longer deploy, maybe, say, seeding the correct scores, and they can maybe only do the under over 2.5 goals and the 1x2 maybe, or maybe they'll just have to reduce some leagues completely or whatever. So essentially you've got people who are just making money time and time again. Effectively, they're just, you know, the exchange price gets very accurate because the arbitrage is very frictionless and easy to do. But also these people really hamper those people who go out their way to just market make as much as possible. And then they're not only doing speed of execution, they're trying to figure out how to game the market maker bots, you know, basically make them move the wrong way, or, you know, pick, you know, or automatically place bets at sort of the wrong spots, these kind of things, market manipulate them a little bit. So essentially you've got someone whose sole ambition is to exploit the market maker, and so then they damage, you know, they're aggressive, so they'll take as much money as they can, you know, they won't just take £2 here and there, and so they essentially you know, will slowly but surely weigh down on the market makers, and the market makers will adapt their business to be less you know, not to be predated in that way. So what do you do about these people? How do you, you know, if they're going to be damaging your future ability to make money on the exchange because they're going to damage volume, which we've all agreed is the way to drive up more commission, it's to get them back in another way. Now, the problem we have here is that, A, they decided to do a fairly blanket measure. They didn't work on a specific basis or target certain behavior close enough. So you had some people who felt, probably quite rightly, that they were being punished for just being good at what they did. They were doing mouse clicks, even the Betfair platform. They weren't even using trading software. They just happened to be good at trading cricket or soccer or tennis, just clicking, backing, and then laying, you know, slowly, but just very assuredly knew what they were doing. And these people had got past that threshold to be paying premium charge, and, you know, their commission level was sort of, well, what they'd paid was quite a bit below the minimum, so suddenly, bang, they got hit by the premium charge. Those people, it feels like if they had been the only, and it's hard to say problem, but I suppose it is problem, then maybe, maybe it wouldn't have been so bad. But, and maybe if the market makers had tailored their business specifically to take on just those people who were aggressive, large stake price takers, maybe a balance could be struck. But then the problem is that the market makers had all made more money than the limit for the Betfair premium charge. And on top of that, they had, you know, they'd got themselves in a situation where they were paying premium charge. So you were punishing the market makers and those people. And then you're also punishing those people maybe who were doing sort of rapid bot strategies. And the thing about some bot strategies, market makers, you allow to sort of pull down orders, put up orders very rapidly, especially in sort of, you know, but people who are just price taking, they just sort of, quite often the bots that were trying to spoof the market, and you get the same situation actually, which the high frequency exchange, high frequency traders did with exchanges. Exchanges were just ill prepared at points when high frequency trading really kicked off to take this many orders placed and removed so rapidly, constant bombardment. So they can also be just a bit of a pain in the ass, which is, you know, the API charging evolved on Betfair, and things like that. So, you know, but yeah, so the premium charge hit probably too many people who maybe weren't necessarily that damaging to the ecosystem. But I saw people on Twitter, for example, saying that, oh, you know, professionals or whatever should pay more. And it's like, well, people who are professionally enabling more trading on the exchange, I don't think they should pay more. You know, they're the lifeblood of the exchange. This is something which, as I've said, has no real point to it, sports betting exchanges. There's no real reason it should exist whatsoever. So, you know, these people who are enabling everyone to sort of live the dream, if you like, I don't think they should be paying premium charge. I think people who put up, you know, resting offers are not price takers or price makers, should have much different structure. In fact, I think every, you know, this is the problem, is it's incredibly tough to build a platform that can manage so many trades. For starters, right, so it's very expensive to run an exchange. It's very hard to process many orders with constant uptime. Betfair, you know, have routinely had system failures, and they arguably have had more practice and taken more volume than anyone else in the exchange. Not arguably, have done in the sports betting exchange world. And even they haven't quite, you know, ever cracked it. That sort of sheer volume of trading that goes on, you know, Saturday, 3 o'clock. So, you know, it's incredibly expensive to do. And, you know, you can't afford for your volumes to be eaten up by people who are just sort of aggressive price takers. So you had to, you know, I can see why the premium charge had to be created to offset some of the costs incurred by this, because they were not just helping themselves, but they were damaging to the market makers. Not to, you know, people say that, oh, the poor little guy was the one who was getting crushed. I don't think that was the problem. So what could they do instead? you know, I think there's different, you know, basically you do almost need to make it too complex is the problem. You'd have to have different commission structures and commission rates for different types of order. And, you know, you'd have, you know, you pay, you know, for me, you know, if you're going to market make into an area or sport where there's virtually no liquidity, you should be absolved of premium charge in that market. You should have, if you're a market maker, you should have lower commission charges than if you're a price taker. You know, I think there's lots of things that you could do to tweak the system, all of which would make it complex and hard for people to get into. And what the price takers and, you know, the market makers really do want is they do want some fresh blood. And unfortunately, they do want people who will make mistakes. You know, it's all peer-to-peer. It's all person-to-person. It's nice if there is some easy money in the pool. Just ask any online poker player. So if there isn't that fresh supply of easy money, which definitely would be put off, it's already a complex idea for most recreational bettors, the betting exchange. If you threw in all sorts of crazy commission charges and differences, that would make it even harder. You know, we look at exchanges now offering up sportsbook interpretation, markets and matchbook, looking to provide those options. You know, that is to increase the amount of recreational users of their services. So for me then to suggest, here's my 10-page commission structure document for you to leave through, that's just absolutely brutal. And a lot of calculations for you to make behind the scenes to make sure everyone pays the right amount at the right time. So I think overall they just looked at the, you know, you create the premium charge, look to see, you know, you create some criteria for premium charge. How many people does this impact? Oh, that looks too many. Well, let's tweak it. That still looks too many. Oh, that looks about right. How much money will that generate? Oh yeah, that looks to plug the current server hole we've got, you know, running, or the admin costs in Stevenage, now Romania, whatever, whatever it may be for Betfair. You know, these people, if they're honest, their earnings are so consistent because they're so rarely losing. And, you know, there's surely no other way that they can be making this kind of money anywhere other than the Betfair exchange, especially as they're, you know, market makers can always find a way to, you know, God, these people could set up a bookmaker, they could do whatever. You know, market makers often have, you know, bigger infrastructure behind them to go do different things. The big money price taker, he's trapped. You know, you've got him locked into the ecosystem. It's hard for him to make that money anywhere else. So not only would you recoup some of that money that you're potentially losing by their behavior, or the potential future money you're losing by their behavior, but also arguably they were often the people who were most able to afford it. But of course, the thing is there were definitely market makers who thought, oh, do you know what, sod this. This has now become a bit irritating. You know, different figures abound. But you know, if we look at someone like Zelko and his syndicate in Australia, a huge percentage of Australian Betfair's racing volume. Huge percentage, would be my understanding. And he wasn't overly impressed, I believe, by the premium charge, so the story goes. And when someone provides that much liquidity to your exchange, you've got to ask yourself, could this have been done differently? Could this have, 'cause, you know, there was a spat, different rumors regarding about how it panned out, you know, were offers made, did he get a different deal, did he not? I don't know. To be honest it's just overly titillating without any real hard fact behind it. To be honest, there are people out there who know exactly how that conversation went, and it wasn't just him, you know, it was other market makers in the exchange. But the reality is that we probably should have kept the 5% on winnings down to 2% for most people, and then a load of people who would be the future premium charge pairs probably should have been taken aside and said, look, this is how it is, this is the problem you're creating, you know, I need you to now either change your behavior if you can, or we'll create a specific commission structure just for you. So let's say there was 1,000 people impacted by the initial premium charge. I don't know how many it was, but you know, they should have almost made bespoke structures for them, because invariably those would be the kind of people who could A, understand the concept of how the exchange needed to evolve, adapt, and survive, but also they were the people to be able to understand, you know, a slightly different commission structure, you know, slightly crazy tweaks to it or whatever. And also the kind of people that maybe you could suggest, look, I know you're really bloody good at tennis, but could you maybe try doing some rugby, or you know, could you try doing a bit more Challenger, because we're suffering for liquidity there. Tell you what, you won't have to pay premium charge on Challenger, you know, or you won't have to pay premium charge on Challenger resting orders, providing they sit on the exchange, providing someone matches with you rather than you matching with them. You pay 2%, no premium charge, you know, and just sort of try and incentivize. And people who wouldn't work with you, well, you know, I'm sorry, fuck them. You know, it's hard work making an exchange that doesn't actually have any reason to exist. So, you know, but I would definitely think that instead of this, people like to say arrogant or whatever, but they did just sort of wade in there, put the charge down, and expect everyone to like it or lump it. And I think that Betfair, you know, Matchbook is driven heavily by market makers, as you would have to be, like any exchange, but also particularly if you're a new exchange. I would suggest that, due to the ties with Mr. Benham, obviously a fair proportion of the soccer liquidity was provided by Smarter Odds, Mr. Benham's syndicate, and that would make good sense. But once again, as a market maker, you know, even the best syndicate in the world, you know, the Tony Blooms, the Benhams of this world, market making and betting is different things, but making and betting are different things. You know, one, you have to behave, one, you can be assured and, you know, confident, one, you have to sometimes exhibit defensiveness, you know, sometimes you have to know the difference between, you know, a late true price when the market's evolved to an early trading price for defense. Yeah. This is my thoughts on it, but it's not easy. And like, if you're Matchbook, you know, you're an exchange, you're going to set yourself up to take a lot of people who are winning. Not only that, but you're going to get people who are paying premium charge elsewhere, so they're clearly fucking bright, and they're then deciding to come over to your exchange because they don't have to pay premium charge there. You almost, as a new exchange, you almost funnel smart people towards yourself because they're people who are successful and dissatisfied with the incumbent exchange. So inevitably, and, you know, Matchbook provide an API, very kind of them. So I'm quite sure there were people who were desperately trying to pick off the smart odds market makers and the like. And these people, again, like I say, they're just actively causing damage to the market maker. And again, you may say, like, well, why can't the market maker just get better? You know, why can't they just make money, do it right, all the rest of it? And it's like, well, on average, these people do, and on average, their system is pretty watertight, you know, and how they move or something like that. But, you know, get really smart people, as smart as Tony. You know, it's one of those things where if you ask Tony Bloom to bet into his own prices, or you ask Ben to bet into his own prices, they could probably beat themselves in a perverse, if you can think of that circular sort of logic. You know, it's bloody hard. So there will be people who will have given a bit of rough trade, I'd imagine, to the Matchbook market makers for various sports. Some of it is going to be pretty simple, sort of Asia Pinnacle blend type odds up for maybe some non-soccer stuff. You know, in that sort of situation, you know, in so much as other people are able to beat Pinnacle, they're going to be able to beat someone who's using, you know, a Pinnacle price as sort of a marker, if you like. So there's going to be price takers who are not market making into this change. Hopefully Matchbook will acquire more market makers. From what I had some people contact me who use Matchbook, they said that they were not, you know, they put through quite significant volumes and they were not having the premium charge attached to them. I think Matchbook needed to put out a disclaimer that saying they were going to do premium charge. I think in an ideal world, Matchbook would have been able to just contact clients one by one and explain the situation. But you couldn't risk the fact that someone might just kick their toys out of the pram, go on Twitter and ranting about, oh, I'm being charged premium charge. Isn't it disgraceful? And other people going, oh, you know, I'm not being charged premium charge. Why is he, you know? So in order to avoid that kind of rampaging discussion, it was better just to put it out there. Like I say, the 20 grand point, I don't know, you know, seems low, but I don't know who that, for all I know, that 20 grand point could just be a fairly arbitrary number because they're only going to apply it specifically to the people who are particularly damaging to the ecosystem. I like to think that those people who are just sort of sedentary, sort of fairly low speed price clickers on Matchbook, you know, particularly on sort of more mature markets, even if they're making a lot of money, those people should be, and those are the kind of people who are hard to make, you know, the really, you know, if they're not exploiting systematic deficiencies or, you know, necessarily, like some live players can be certain, there's still a lot of Matchbook liquidity is based around pre-match. So yeah, so beating a solid pre-match price by sort of huge margins is quite difficult. So the premium charge maybe won't impact those kind of people too much, which are a lot of the people that they have tried to attract. Smark, I noticed that Trost would not be held down to not offering a premium charge, again, because he probably recognises the problem that he could potentially face. He is the majority of the market making on Smarkets. So, and you know, they are very hesitant about letting anyone use access to their API, and that is probably a good way of avoiding a lot of premium charge style business, or the kind of business that you would need to premium charge in order to sort of rein it in, is by just not allowing people to play in the sand pit in the first place, and certainly not in that sort of high frequency trading type way or anything that would exploit the market maker. You know, Smarkets is undoubtedly reliant on the other exchanges to give it indication of how to make its own markets. So, you know, if you allowed someone with access to a Betfair API, access to a Smarkets API, access to a Matchbook API, to just run wild, I'm pretty sure that you could do incredible damage, you know, particularly if you knew which was the head of the dog and which was the tail. Invariably, Smarkets, I think, is going to be the tail, as you know, it's sort of in there, in the way that they've evolved. So, yeah, so I can see why he wouldn't be held to account on that, and I wouldn't rule out Smarkets having a premium charge. Again, sadly, you know, if they don't do it in a more sophisticated manager, you'll capture a lot of people who've just become good at what they do. I say sadly, I mean, you know, you've had a good run. You know, you've made an awful lot of money tax-free. So, you know, it's probably not the, you know, if you look at someone who pays, you know, all the traders in the city who set themselves up as sort of one-man companies, effectively, you know, paying 20-odd% or so, you know, that, you know, it doesn't seem unreasonable that some of the higher premium charges does seem just like ill-conceived, basically, just like a sort of almost how much can we get away with in a way, and, you know, you still take it, I suppose. 20% seemed much more reasonable. But again, I don't know the costs of running the infrastructure, and I don't know, you know, what the new account signups have been tailing off, or how many fresh deposits are in the ecosystem and so on. So I don't know how much they need to claw back. And you know, there's only, you know, if you've got a wealthy set of clients with sort of the deepest of deep pockets, you're always going to go back and try and ask for more from them than anyone else. So, well, you know, both Matchbook and Smarkets are going to try and get a bit more money in the coffers by having a bookmaker frontage or bookmaker style frontage. One thing I would say is that, and they probably won't do this because everyone loves just laying value bets, obviously, you know, laying bets that are good value to themselves. But what you could do if you're an exchange and you wanted to boost liquidity, if you wanted to benefit all concerned and make a bit of a smaller margin in the process, is if you were to sort of mirror boost liquidity with a bit of extra margin built in. So let's say you had a 10 runner horse race on your exchange, and the exchange is betting it to like sort of 102%, whatever, it's pretty close to sort of true prices. And you decided that you wanted to offer a bookmaker overlay with a minimum takeout of a grand. And there was a horse, you know, that was available at 13s on the exchange, but it was available in, you know, a tenner, and you wanted to be able to offer it on the bookmaker facing, you know, so you offer 11s, 10 to 1, and you want to be able to offer, you know, 100 quid there. So you're basically hoping that between the 11s, the 12s, and the 13s, and the money that's there, you would be able to offer that much liquidity. Now, you don't know, then it's nothing on the order book, maybe, nothing on, maybe there's not even anything at 12s, maybe it's a 10 at 12s, 20 at 13s, whatever. So you're taking a bit of a gamble, but you're going to assure that liquidity. Now, if what you did in that instance was when someone hit you and took that 100 quid at 11s, if you immediately took all the money bigger than 11s on the exchange, you as a company, so you basically put that money straight through into the exchange, and then you left at 11 the remainder. Essentially then, you leave money on your exchange. So you've shared some of that value back. So the price was 13s, we think, thereabouts. There's money there. You've laid it at 11s. You know, you now have this, you've taken your bit of value. You're now saying to someone else, right, well, I've taken, you know, I've laid something at 11s that was 13s. Here you go. If we assume that 13s was the correct price, I'm now putting up some 11s there for other people on the exchange to pick on. In the same way that for me, one of the things that would be beneficial that, say, Betfair never did was I always thought that the trading aspect and the financial trading mentality, I don't believe in applying all these financial chart tools to the Betfair charts and so on. I believe the markets behave slightly differently. They don't quite have the volume or the behavior that maybe makes them work. I don't even necessarily believe in some of the charting practices, to be honest, in financial markets. But I know that people absolutely love them. People love technical and charters trading and recreational in sort of amateur financial trading, if you like. People loved charts. You'd see new traders and they'd have a billion lines on the charts, most complex strategies possible. I'm happy for, you know, if it brings people into the sports betting exchanges, Betfair should have plugged that. You know, it took them so long to have a cash out button, and it's a really fucking shit execution of it as well, to be honest. You're invariably better off using the third-party trading softwares to do your greening up than the bloody cash out they give you. They should have had things like, you know, submit trade, it automatically puts in a lay. So you could have been able to say, right, well, I'm back something at 10s, and I want to lay at 5 tick, you know, tick up, 1 tick, 2 tick, 3, 4, 5 tick, right, I want to lay back 5 ticks away. All these kind of things that the financial trading softwares, third parties did, Betfair could have integrated to make it people feel like it was that more financial trading thing. You know, I've got a target price that I want to get to, that kind of thing. Or maybe even, I don't know, stop orders means that you've got to have a server that keeps track of a lot of fucking orders, and it's a nightmare. I can, again, speak from experience of a system that, you know, struggled with the number of financial orders that people were placing on it. But, you know, this idea that you can sort of set up a trade, set and forget trades, hugely appealing to the recreational trader. So, and the great thing is that it's you know, what is great for, you know, the price takers and the market makers, you know, horse racing is fabulous, right? I'm going to back this horse at 10s. I'm going to put an in-running lay at 5s. The only time that 5s gets taken out is when someone generally smart enough realizes that 5s is too big. So you've got this fabulous situation where this person, they're happy, they've done the trade that suits their risk profile, they think they're happy with it, and you provide basically a waiting juicy order on your order book for smart people to then pick up. So they should have facilitated a way to create more orders on the exchange, but they didn't go down that route. Disappointing. In the same way, if you had an overlay, bookmaker overlay on top of your exchange, some of the orders that aren't fully completed or you can't fully match yourself should filter onto the exchange so that they can then be matched, in my opinion. Now, you may say, well, if someone's taking 11s about something that's 13s, why would I give any of it away? Well, it depends whether you want to be a bookmaker, you want to be an exchange, or you want to be a hybrid. I think the hybrid needs to share the wealth a little bit. But yes, it'd be interesting to see how much that adds liquidity. It will add liquidity to the company whether any of that liquidity will again materialize on the exchange or not. I don't know. So does this create quite a pessimistic view of sports betting exchanges as a whole? Potentially it does. You know, it's entirely possible that everyone realizes in the future we're running around for, you know, to make 5% on our money when we could be making 20% on our money doing something else, whatever. I do think that there's, you know, the Paddy Power Betfair group, you know, they're happy to pick up the money that the Betfair exchange makes. They're happy to cut some costs, maybe squeeze it a bit more. And people say to me, oh, look, there's some new advertising or there's a new TV advert. There's not real big efforts being made to really make the exchange as good as it can be, I think. But, you know, I hope that Matchbook and Smarkets and BetDAC, I haven't mentioned BetDAC once. I'm not really sure. BetDAC seem to have, you know, they've got no charging. They've got 2% for, is it new customers? Maybe even existing customers now. But, you know, they've got pretty low commissions. You know, who knows what they plan to do. I don't even really know much about the market making in the back end for BetDAC. You know, it's debatable how much Ladbrokes Coral's doing for it, I would say. But yes, so I think that premium charging is, I'm not even going to call it a necessary evil. I think it is necessary in order to balance out some of the people who are going to beat up on your liquidity provision. I do think it could be structured much better. I do think it doesn't need to be as aggressive for everyone as it is potentially. But I do think that, you know, I don't believe necessarily the Matchbook commission structure is perfect either. You know, you want people who put up a lot of orders. I think at times, particularly as, you know, live betting evolves on Matchbook. Although I have heard that, you know, there's been some comparisons done with people's business where, you know, Matchbook will do the analysis for you. You know, here's what you would have paid on this style commission, Betfair style commission, here's what you pay with us. You know, how does it compare? And it's compared very favorably for a lot of their clients, or been not much in it for other clients potentially. But yeah, just the idea that you could choose which commission structure you wanted for an exchange, just one or the other. Or potentially, as the exchange, you could force people onto one or the other, depending on what would basically generate more commission. But all these things that I've talked about, they're all things that require people to really bloody love making a great betting exchange, plow even more money into more robust servers, into more robust APIs, you know, better quality interfaces, you know, just plowing more and more money in for not necessarily a huge amount of new clients to use it. And believe me, if it ever does become just pros against pros completely, aggressive price takers versus price makers, well, that pie is just going to shrink and shrink and shrink over time. You know, I know a lot of the new US people are talking about how exchanges are going to be the best thing ever, the most fair thing for American punters. Maybe that will provide the necessary lift. But I do think, you know, like I say, when you don't have a diverse ecosystem like the financial markets, you do need to basically put in artificial rules to, you know, create the kind of environment that you want. So yeah, I'm sorry if there's people out there who pay a lot of premium charge and think I'm a fucking twat. Well, that's, you know, entirely your prerogative. And if you think I've got it all wrong, absolutely, that's, you know, entirely very possible as well. And if you work for an exchange and you think I'm talking crap, or if you think that I've talked a lot of sense, then do please like and retweet it and say, yep, Matthew seems to understand our business quite well. Or alternatively, you know, what a load of shit. You know, all interaction is good interaction. Right, so there we go. I've crept past the hour mark again. I knew this show was probably going to be a bit of a come down after the previous show. I hope it's still been interesting to some people. And I hope you persist with me and come back for whatever I decide to talk about next as well. Thank you for listening.